and that you made your livelihood at, and that has brought joy to people all over the world, Levan says. Billy was finally silenced. She had no money to look after herself or to eat properly. She couldn't even rent an apartment in her own name. One night, Billy fell over drunk, and her friend Greer Johnson found her sobbing on the floor.
Baby, fuck it. Honest to Christ, I'm never gonna sing again no more.
What the hell do you think you can do if you don't sing? Greer asked, according to Julia Blackburn.
I don't give a fuck.
Fine. And then what would you do, Billy?
She muttered, I'll sing again.
You're damn right you will. Another of her friends kept telling her she could save enough money to retire to a house with a garden where she could have babies.
Do you think I can? Do you think I can do it?
She asked incredulously. She dreamed of getting a big farm somewhere and turning it into a home for orphaned children where she'd run the kitchen herself. Sometimes she would go to visit her baby godson, Bevan Dufty, at his family's apartment on 94th Street, and she would suckle him. Although she had no milk, it seemed to reassure her.
Bitch, this is my baby,
she would tell his mother, laughing. The only other way she could soothe herself was by returning to childhood habits of her own. She would lie in bed all day, reading Superman comics and chuckling. One day, she went out with a teenage friend to Central Park. They fed LSD to the horses and then took a ride. The cabbie was puzzled. Why wouldn't the horses follow their normal route? Billy cackled with laughter from her carriage. But when she was forced to interact with people, she was becoming more and more paranoid. If Jimmy Fletcher had been one of them, who else was? She believed, correctly it turns out, that some of the people around her were informing on her to Anslinger's army.
You didn't know who to trust, her friend Yolande Bevan told me. So-called friends. Were they friends? What were they?
Everywhere she went, there were agents asking about her, demanding details. She began to push away even her few remaining friends because she was terrified the police would plant drugs on them, too, and that was the last thing she wanted for the people she loved. One day, Harry Anslinger was told that there were also white women, just as famous as Billy, who had drug problems, but he responded to them rather differently. He called Julie Garland, another heroin addict, in to see him. They had a friendly chat, in which he advised her to take longer vacations between pictures, and he wrote to her studio, assuring them she didn't have a drug problem at all. When he discovered that a Washington Society hostess he knew, a beautiful, gracious lady, he noted, had an illegal drug addiction, he explained he couldn't possibly arrest her because it would destroy the unblemished reputation of one of the nation's most honored families. He helped her to wean herself off her addiction slowly, without the law becoming involved. As I sat in his archives, reading over the piles of fading papers that survived from the launch of the drug war, there was one thing I found hardest to grasp at first. The arguments we hear today for the drug war are that we must protect teenagers from drugs and prevent addiction in general. We assume, looking back, that these were the reasons this war was launched in the first place. But they were not. They crop up only occasionally as asides. The main reason given for banning drugs, the reason obsessing the men who launched this war, was that the blacks, Mexicans, and Chinese were using these chemicals, forgetting their place, and menacing white people. It took me a while to see that the contrast between the racism directed at Billy and the compassion offered to addicted white stars like Julie Garland was not some weird misfiring of the drug war. It was part of the point. Harry told the public that the increase in drug addiction is practically 100% among Negro people.
which he stressed was terrifying, because already, "The Negro population accounts for 10% of the total population, but 60% of the addicts." He would wage the drug war, he could do what he did, only because he was responding to a fear in the American people. You can be a great surfer, but you still need a great wave. Harry's wave came in the form of a race panic. In the run-up to the passing of the Harrison Act, the New York Times ran a story typical of the time. The headline was, "Negro Cocaine Fiends, New Southern Menace." It described a North Carolina police chief who was informed that a hitherto inoffensive Negro, with whom he was well acquainted, was running amok in a cocaine frenzy and had attempted to stab a storekeeper. Knowing he must kill this man or be killed himself, the chief drew his revolver, placed the muzzle over the Negro's heart, and fired, intending to kill him right quick, as the officer tells it, but the shot did not even stagger the man. Cocaine was, it was widely claimed in the press at this time, turning blacks into superhuman hulks who could take bullets to the heart without flinching. It was the official reason why the police across the South increased the caliber of their guns. One medical expert put it bluntly. "The cocaine nigger," he warned, "sure is hard to kill." Many white Americans did not want to accept that black Americans might be rebelling because they had lives like Billie Holiday's, locked into pig towns and banned from developing their talents. It was more comforting to believe that a white powder was the cause of black anger, and that getting rid of the white powder would render black Americans docile and on their knees once again. The history of this would be traced years later in Michel Alexander's remarkable book, The New Jim Crow. But there was another racial group that also had to be kept down, Harry believed. In the mid-19th century, Chinese immigrants had begun to flow into the United States, and they were now competing with white people for jobs and opportunities. Worse still, Harry believed they were competing for white women. He warned that with their own special Oriental ruthlessness, the Chinese had developed a liking for the charms of Caucasian girls from good families. They lured these white girls into their opium dens, a tradition they had brought from their home country, got the girls hooked, and then forced them into acts of unspeakable sexual depravity for the rest of their lives. Anslinger described their brothels in great detail, how the white girls removed their clothes slowly, the panties they revealed, how slowly they kissed the Chinese, and what came next. Once the Chinese dealers got you hooked on opiates, they would laugh in your face and reveal the real reason they sell junk. It was their way of making sure that the yellow race would rule the world. They were too wise, they urged, to attempt to win in battle, but they would win by wits. They would strike at the white race through dope, and when the time was ripe, would command the world, explained a senior judge. At first, ordinary citizens had taken matters into their own hands against this yellow peril. In Los Angeles, 21 Chinese people were shot, hanged, or burned alive by white mobs, while in San Francisco, officials tried to forcibly remove everyone in Chinatown into an area reserved for pig farms and other businesses that were designated as dirty and disease-ridden, until the courts ruled the policy was unconstitutional. So the authorities did the next best thing. They launched mass raids on Chinese homes and businesses, saying it was time to stop their opium use. The agents built a bonfire of opium-smoking equipment with flames shooting 30 feet into the air. As one observer put it, "The choking smoke spread its heavy mantle over Chinatown like a pall upon the dead." The Harrison Act followed soon after. Harry Anslinger did not create these underlying trends. His genius wasn't for invention. It was for presenting his agents as the hand that would steady all these cultural tremblings. He knew that to secure his bureau's future, he needed a high-profile victory over intoxication and over blacks, and so he turned back to Billie Holiday. To finish her off, he called for his toughest agent, a man who was at no risk of falling in love with her, or anyone else. The Japanese man couldn't breathe. Colonel George White, a vastly obese white slab of a man, had his hands tightened around his throat, and he was not letting go. It was the last the Japanese man ever saw. Once it was all over, White told the authorities he had strangled this Jap because he believed he was a spy. But privately, he told his friends he didn't really know if his victim was a spy at all, and he didn't care. "I have a lot of friends who are murderers," he bragged years later, "and I had very good times in their company." He boasted to his friends that he kept a photo of the man he had throttled hanging on the wall of his apartment, always watching him. So, as he got to work on Billy, Colonel White was watched by his last victim, and this made him happy. He was Harry Anslinger's favorite agent, and when he looked over Holiday's files, he declared her to be a very attractive customer, because the bureau was at a loose end, and could do with the opportunity to kick her over. White had been a journalist in San Francisco in the 1930s, until he applied to join the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. The personality tests given to all applicants on Anslinger's orders found that he was a sadist. He quickly rose through the Bureau's ranks. He became a sensation as the first and only white man ever to infiltrate a Chinese drug gang, and he even learned to speak in Mandarin so he could chant their oaths with them. In his downtime, he would go swimming in the filthy waters of New York City's Hudson River, as if daring it to poison him. He was especially angered that this black woman didn't know her place. She flaunted her way of living, with her fancy coats and fancy automobiles, and her jewelry and her gowns, he complained. She was the big lady wherever she went. When he came for her, on a rainy day at the Mark Twain Hotel in San Francisco, without a search warrant, Billy was sitting in white silk pajamas in her room. This was one of the few places she could still perform, and she badly needed the money. She insisted to the police that she had been clean for over a year. White's men declared they had found opium stashed in a waste paper basket next to a side room, and the kit for shooting heroin in the room, and they charged her with possession. But when the details were looked at later, there seemed to be something odd. A waste paper basket seems an improbable place to keep a stash, and the kit for shooting heroin was never entered into evidence by the cops. They said they left it at the scene. When journalists asked White about this, he blustered. His reply, they noted, appeared a little defensive. That night, White came to Billy's show at the Cafe Society uptown, and he requested his favorite songs. She never lost faith in her music's ability to capture and persuade. "They'll remember me," she said, "when all this is gone and they've finished badgering me." George White did not agree. "I did not think much of Miss Holiday's performance," he told her manager sternly. Billy insisted the junk had been planted in her room by White, and she immediately offered to go to a clinic to be monitored. She would experience no withdrawal symptoms, she said, and that would prove she was clean and being framed. She checked herself in at a cost of $1,000, and she didn't so much as shiver. George White, it turns out, had a long history of planting drugs on women. He was fond of pretending to be an artist and luring women to an apartment in Greenwich Village, where he would spike their drinks with LSD to see what would happen. One of his victims was a young actress who happened to live in his building, while another was a pretty blonde waitress in a bar. After she failed to show any sexual interest in him, he drugged her to see if that would change.
I toiled wholeheartedly in the vineyards because it was fun, fun, fun.
White boasted.
Where else but in the Bureau of Narcotics could a red-blooded American boy lie, kill, cheat, steal, rape, and pillage with the sanction and blessing of the All-Highest?
He may well have been high when he busted Billy for getting high. The prosecution of Billy went ahead. "The hounding and the pressure drove me," she wrote, "to think of trying the final solution, death." Her best friend said it caused Billy enough anxiety as to kill a horse. At the trial, a jury of 12 ordinary citizens heard all the evidence. They sided with Billy against Anslinger and White and found her not guilty. Nonetheless,
"She had slipped from the peak of her fame," Harry Anslinger wrote. "Her voice was cracking."
In the years after Billy's trial, many other singers were too afraid of being harassed by the authorities to perform Strange Fruit. But Billie Holiday refused to stop. No matter what they did to her, she sang her song. "She was," her friend Annie Ross told me, "as strong as she could be." To the end, Billie Holiday kept the promise she had made to herself back in Baltimore when she was a little girl. She didn't bow her head to anyone. When Billie was 44 years old, a young musician named Frankie Freedom was serving her a bowl of oatmeal and custard in his apartment when she suddenly collapsed. She was taken to the Knickerbocker Hospital in Manhattan and made to wait for an hour and a half on a stretcher, and they said she was a drug addict and turned her away. One of the ambulance drivers recognized her, so she ended up in a public ward of New York City's Metropolitan Hospital. As soon as they took her off oxygen, she lit a cigarette.
"Some damn body is always trying to embalm me," she said.
But the doctors came back and explained she had an array of very serious illnesses. She was emaciated because she had not been eating. She had cirrhosis of the liver because of chronic drinking. She had cardiac and respiratory problems due to chronic smoking, and she had several leg ulcers caused by starting to inject street heroin once again. They said she was unlikely to survive for long. But Harry wasn't done with her yet.
"You watch, baby,"
Billy warned from her tiny gray hospital room.
"They're going to arrest me in this damn bed."
Narcotics agents were sent to her hospital bed and said they found less than 1/8 of an ounce of heroin in a tinfoil envelope. They claimed it was hanging on a nail on the wall, 6 feet from the bottom of her bed, a spot Billy was incapable of reaching. They summoned a grand jury to indict her, telling her that unless she disclosed her dealer, they would take her straight to prison. They confiscated her comic books, radio, record player, flowers, chocolates, and magazines, handcuffed her to the bed, and stationed 2 policemen at the door. They had orders to forbid any visitors from coming in without a written permit, and her friends were told there was no way to see her. Her friend, Maley Dufty, screamed at them that it was against the law to arrest somebody who was on the critical list. They explained that the problem had been solved. They had taken her off the critical list. So now, on top of the cirrhosis of the liver, Billy went into heroin withdrawal alone. A doctor was brought into the hospital at the insistence of her friends to prescribe methadone. She was given it for 10 days and began to recover. She put on weight and looked better. But then the methadone was suddenly stopped, and she began to sicken again. When finally a friend was allowed in to see her, Billy told her in a panic,
"They're going to kill me. They're going to kill me in there. Don't let them."
The police threw the friend out.
"I had very high hopes that she would be able to come out of it alive."
Another friend, Alice Verbsky, told the BBC, "until all this happened.
It was the last straw."
One day, her pimp husband, Lewis McKay, turned up at the hospital, after informing on her.
and ostentatiously read the 23rd Psalm over her bed. It turned out he wanted her to sign over the rights to her autobiography to him, the last thing she still controlled. She pretended to be unconscious. As soon as he was gone, she opened her eyes. "I've always been a religious bitch," she said, "but if that dirty motherfucker believes in God, I'm thinking it over." On the street outside of the hospital, protesters gathered, led by a Harlem pastor named the Reverend Eugene Callender. They held up signs reading, "Let Lady Live." Callender had built a clinic for heroin addicts in his church, and he pleaded for Billy to be allowed to go there to be nursed back to health. His reasoning was simple, he told me in 2013. "Addicts," he said, "are human beings, just like you and me. Punishment makes them sicker. Compassion can make them well." Harry and his men refused. They fingerprinted Billy on her hospital bed. They took a mugshot of her on her hospital bed. They grilled her on her hospital bed without letting her talk to a lawyer. Billy didn't blame Anslinger's agents as individuals. She blamed the drug war itself, because it forced the police to treat ill people like criminals. "Imagine if the government chased sick people with diabetes, put a tax on insulin and drove it into the black market, told doctors they couldn't treat them," she wrote in her memoir, "then sent them to jail. If we did that, everyone would know we were crazy. Yet we do practically the same thing every day in the week to sick people hooked on drugs." Still, some part of Billie Holiday believed she had done something evil with her drug use and with her life. She told people she would rather die than go back to prison, but she was terrified that she would burn in hell, just as her mother had said she would all those years before. When she was a little girl, lying on the brothel floor, listening to Louis Armstrong's music, and letting it carry her out of Baltimore. "She was exhausted," one of her friends told me. "She didn't want to go through it no more." And so, when she died on this bed, with police officers at the door to protect the public from her, she looked, as another of her friends told the BBC, "as if she had been torn from life violently." She had 15 $50 bills strapped to her leg. It was all she had left. She was intending to give it to the nurses who had looked after her, to thank them. Her best friend, Maylie Dufty, insisted to anyone who would listen that Billy had been effectively murdered by a conspiracy to break her, orchestrated by the narcotics police. But what could she do? At Billy's funeral, there were swarms of police cars because they feared their actions against her would trigger a riot. In his eulogy for her, the Reverend Eugene Callender told me he had said, "We should not be here. This young lady was gifted by her creator with tremendous talent. She should have lived to be at least 80 years old." The Federal Bureau of Narcotics saw differently. "For her," Harry wrote with satisfaction, "there would be no more good morning heartache." It is easy to judge Harry Anslinger. But if we're honest, I suspect that everybody who has ever loved an addict, everybody who has ever been an addict, has this impulse in them somewhere. Destroy the addiction. Kill the addiction. Throttle it with violence. Harry Anslinger is our own darkest impulses, given a government department and a license to kill. As I researched this book, I traveled a long way from the farm fields of Pennsylvania, but at every step I began to feel I was chasing the scream that terrified little Harry Anslinger all those years ago as it echoed out across the world. In his private files, Harry kept a poem that had been sent in by an admiring member of the public, addressed directly to him. It defined for Harry his mission in life. Until the day that the great judge proclaims the last addicts died, the poem said, then, not till then, may you be retired. Chapter 2 Sunshine and Weaklings. In Harry Anslinger's files, I began to notice a few names that he raged against repeatedly, as monsters who were trying to sabotage his work and spread drugs throughout America. This intrigued me. Who were these people? Who, for example, were Edward Williams and Henry Smith Williams? I began to follow a paper trail through file folders, old court records, and yellowing books, until I uncovered a story that, as far as I can tell, has been almost entirely forgotten for more than 60 years now. Yet it has the power to transform how we see this whole war. The drug war was born in the United States, but so was the resistance to it. Right at the start, there were people who saw that the drug war was not what they were being told. It was something else entirely. Harry Anslinger wanted to make sure that we would never put these pieces together. In the sunshine of Los Angeles, there was a doctor in the early 1930s named Henry Smith Williams, with a long, unsmiling face. He wore small, wire-framed glasses through which he peered down on the world and at almost everyone in it. This doctor shared all of Harry Anslinger's hatreds. He said that addicts were weaklings who should never have been brought into the world, and wrote that the idea that every human life has genuine value, and therefore is something to be treasured, is an absurd banality. The world would be far better off if 40% of its inhabitants had never been born. In his view, drugs led only to destruction, and nobody should take them. Ever. But sometimes, as a historical trend is forming, there is one person who can see what it will mean for humanity way ahead of everyone else, and sometimes these prophets come in the most unlikely form. Henry Smith Williams was about to announce in a detailed new book that he had made a remarkable discovery, one he believed would make this new war on drugs untenable. While Harry Anslinger was raging against the Mafia in public, he was, in fact, secretly working for them. The drug war had been created, Henry said, for one reason and one reason alone. The Mafia paid Harry Anslinger to launch his crusade because they wanted the drug market all to themselves. It was the scam of the century. It was about, at last, to be exposed. The long road that led Henry to this conviction began one day in 1931 when a man shivered into the clinic run by Henry's brother, Edward Williams. He was suffering all the obvious signs of heroin withdrawal, so he was in the right place. Edward was one of the most distinguished experts on opiate addiction in the world. "The man is a wreck, at the verge of collapse," Henry wrote. "He is deathly pale. Sweat pours from his skin. He is all tremor. His life seems threatened." Both brothers had seen people like this in their offices for many years. Henry believed, in his social Darwinist way, that they were weaklings who had survived only because they had been stupidly coddled by society. In a state of nature, they would have died to make way for stronger men with better genes. Yet Edward couldn't bear to see their suffering, not when he knew there was a way to stop their pain. That is why he had helped to set up this clinic, and why he was about to be ruined.
"Can the doctor do nothing?" "Oh, yes. The doctor knows just what should be done," he explained. "He knows that he has but to write a few words on the prescription blank that lies at his elbow, and the patient, tottering to the nearest drugstore, will receive the remedy that would restore him miraculously to a semblance of normality, and the actuality of physical and mental comfort."
He can provide a legal prescription for the drug to which the patient has become addicted. It will not damage his body. All doctors agree that pure opiates do no harm to the flesh or the organs. The patient, after taking the drug, will become calm. He will be able to function again. He will be able to work, or support a family, or love. So Edward Williams wrote the prescription. He had done it many times, and he was confident he had the law on his side. He was given even more confidence when the Supreme Court ruled in 1925 that the Harrison Act didn't give the government the authority to punish doctors who believed it was in the best interests of their addicted patients to prescribe them heroin. But on this particular day, in 1931, the addict was not what he seemed. He was, in fact, working for Harry Anslinger as one of a flock of stool pigeons the Bureau was sending out across the country to trick doctors. They were desperate addicts tossed a few dollars by the Bureau to con doctors into treating them. Once the prescription was written, the police burst into the room, and Edward Williams was busted, alongside some 20,000 other doctors across the country, in one of the biggest legal assaults on doctors in American history. Most of the people the Bureau had picked on up to now, addicts and African Americans, were in no position to fight back. But Henry Smith Williams was one of the most respected medical authorities in the United States. He was said to know more about the chemistry and biology of the blood cells than any other man in America, and he had written a 31-volume history of science and many entries in the Encyclopedia Britannica, all in his spare time, left over from treating more than 10,000 patients. So, in the aftermath of his brother's arrest, Henry started to investigate, and he uncovered something he didn't expect. As he watched his brother's career being destroyed by the police, Henry remembered something that now seemed to him, for the first time, to be significant. Before it became a crime to sell drugs, he had many patients who used them, but things had been very different then. They had bought their opiates, including morphine and heroin, at a low price from their local pharmacist. They were sold in bottles as remedies, or little helpers, for everything from a chest infection to the blues. One of the most popular was called Mrs. Winslow's Soothing Syrup, of which each ounce you bought contained 65 milligrams of pure morphine. The vast majority of people who bought them, he recalled, used them without a problem. Most people, even addicts, used them in low doses. "No one thought of the use of these medicines as having any moral significance," he explained. One famous campaigner against alcohol was addicted to morphine, and nobody thought this was odd or hypocritical. There were many women who used opiates in the form of syrups every day who, he said, would have gone on their hands and knees to pray for a lost soul had they seen cigarette stains on the fingers of a daughter. Just as a large majority of drinkers did not become alcoholics, a large majority of users of these products did not become drug addicts. They used opiates as props for the unstable nervous system, like a person who drinks wine at the end of a stressful day at work. A small number did get hooked, but even among the addicted, the vast majority continued to work and maintain relatively normal lives. An official government study found that before drug prohibition properly kicked in, 3/4 of self-described addicts, not just users, addicts, had steady and respectable jobs. Some 22% of addicts were wealthy, while only 6% were poor. They were more sedate as a result of their addiction, and although it would have been better for them to stop, they were rarely out of control or criminal. But in 1914, the Harrison Act was passed, and then Anslinger arrived 16 years later to rapidly ratchet it up. Doctors saw the results of the policy changes. Here were tens of thousands of people, in every walk of life,
frantically craving drugs that they could in no legal way secure, Henry wrote. They craved the drugs as a man dying of thirst craves water. They must have the drugs at any hazard, at any cost. Can you imagine that situation, and suppose that the drugs will not be supplied? The lawmakers must have known that their edict, if enforced, was the clear equivalent of an order to create an illicit drug industry. They must have known that they were, in effect, ordering a company of drug smugglers into existence.
The drug dealer could now charge extortionate prices. In the pharmacies, morphine had cost 2 or 3 cents a grain. The criminal gangs charged a dollar. The addicts paid whatever they were told to pay. The world we recognize now, where addicts are often forced to become criminals in a desperate scramble to feed their habit from gangsters, was being created for the first time. The Williams brothers had watched as Anslinger's department created 2 crime waves. First, it created an army of gangsters to smuggle drugs into the country and sell them to addicts. In other words, while Harry Anslinger claimed to be fighting the mafia, he was in fact transferring a massive and highly profitable industry into their exclusive control. Second, by driving up the cost of drugs by more than 1,000%, the new policies meant addicts were forced to commit crime to get the next fix.
How was the average addict, revealed by the official census as an average person, to secure $10 or $15 a day to pay for the drug he imperatively needed?
Henry Smith Williams asked.
Can you guess the answer? The addict could not get such a sum by ordinary means. He must get it by dubious means. He must beg, borrow, forge, steal.
The men, he wrote, usually became thieves. The women often became prostitutes.
The United States government, as represented by its anti-drug officers, Henry explained, had just become the greatest and most potent maker of criminals in any recent century.
And every time Harry Anslinger created new drug criminals, he created new reasons for his department to be saved and to grow. The road to Edward Huntington Williams' arrest had begun when he became slowly convinced that there was a better way to respond to the problem of drug addiction, one that was already perfectly legal. When the Harrison Act banning heroin and cocaine was written in 1914, it contained a very clear and deliberately designed loophole. It said that doctors, vets, and dentists had the right to continue giving out these drugs as they saw fit, and that addicts should be dealt with compassionately in this way. Yet the loophole was tossed into the trash heap of history as if it didn't exist, until Edward Williams decided to dig it out and act on it. He helped to build a free clinic for addicts, and he volunteered his own time there. He wrote his prescriptions for whoever needed them, and he waited to see the results. Even he was surprised by what he saw. Patients who had come in as unemployed physical wrecks were able, slowly and steadily, to go back to work, support their families, and look after themselves again, just as they had before drugs were criminalized. The order and calm that had existed before narcotics prohibition started to return to their neighborhoods. The mayor of Los Angeles came out and celebrated the clinic as a great gift to the city, and the local federal prosecutor announced that these clinics accomplished more good in one day than all the prosecutions in one month. Thousands of miles away, the Federal Bureau of Narcotics was furious. Harry kept picturing the addicts he had seen in his childhood and in Europe, and he wanted to stop this contagion from spreading. Or did he, as Henry Smith Williams was beginning to suspect, have darker motives? Harry said that building clinics for heroin addicts was like providing department stores for kleptomaniacs, where they could steal whatever they wanted. The tabloid newspapers, after briefings from the Bureau, savaged the clinics as dens of sin, and the stool pigeons began their flight. In Portland, Oregon, a doctor stood in his clinic as Anslinger's men forcibly shut its doors and asked them pleadingly, was there anything he could legally do to help these addicts?
Yeah, sure. There's plenty you can do, the agent told him. Run the whole bunch of them down to the ocean and kick them in. They'll make fair fish food. That's all any of them are good for.
After the clinic in Los Angeles closed and doctors like Edward Williams were busted, almost all the addicts lost their jobs and were reduced once again to constant scrambling for the money for a fix. They fell into crime and homelessness, and dozens of them died. The Bureau was defying the clear ruling of the Supreme Court that the Harrison Act allowed doctors to prescribe to addicts, but
the Supreme Court has no army to enforce its decisions, the press noted with a shrug.
Some 20,000 doctors were charged with violating the Harrison Act, alongside Edward Williams, and 95% were convicted. Most were charged massive fines, but some faced 5 years in prison for each and every prescription written. In many places, horrified juries refused to convict because they could see the doctors were only treating the sick as best they could. But Anslinger's crackdown continued with full force. Harry wanted Edward Williams to be broken more than any other doctor because he was widely respected and many people listened to him.
The moral effect of his conviction, Anslinger wrote, will most certainly result in greater circumspection.
You only have to destroy a few doctors to silence the rest. Go for the top. Maximum intimidation. This was always Harry's way.
Anybody that came out with any academic work that could be critical of him, his bureau, or his philosophy, had to go to prison,
Howard Diller, one of his agents, said later.
Or be beheaded.
As he watched the birth of the drug war, Henry Smith Williams, cold, chilly, arrogant, felt a war breaking out within himself. Part of him believed addicts were the result of barbaric genes left over from cavemen, and the sooner they died off, the better. But he was also seeing the faces of the individual human beings who were being broken, and he saw the work of Anslinger in the world, and began to question the Anslinger in his own heart. He went to meet Harry Anslinger in Washington, D.C., to plead for his brother's reputation and freedom. Harry was now confronted with one of his victims face to face, perhaps for the first time. He offered no defense of himself, and he put forward none of the arguments he proclaimed so loudly elsewhere. He backed off. He said that he
could not discover that the Bureau had any case against Dr. Williams, and could not understand why such a man had been attacked.
He put all the blame on his Los Angeles representative, a big redhead agent named Chris Hansen. Yet, after Williams was gone, Anslinger privately jeered at him, saying that Henry Smith Williams was suffering from hysteria. At the trial, every single one of the 17 doctors who testified supported Edward Williams, yet he was found guilty of violating the Harrison Act, in effect of being a drug dealer, and sentenced to a year on federal probation. This ensured he would never again write a prescription for an addict, nor would any other doctor in the United States for generations to come.
Doctors, Harry boasted, now cannot treat addicts even if they wish to.
Harry's own agents began to quit in disgust. One of them, William G. Walker, said,
if anyone could see the suffering of these poor devils, they would understand why we should have a change.
One doctor, stripped of his power to prescribe, decided he had to stop this cruelty once and for all. He traveled to Washington, D.C. with a gun stuffed into his coat. He was determined to walk into Harry Anslinger's office and kill him. He stood outside Harry's office until he was finally allowed in. Anslinger offered to take the doctor's coat, and, as he reached for it, snatched the gun. Harry boasted later that even if the doctor had taken a shot at him, he would have made a sieve out of him by firing first. None of this gave Harry pause. The doctors were so emotional, Harry insisted, because they were corrupt. Don't be fooled. They only wanted the money from the drug addict's prescriptions. They were missing the hard cash, he said, and nothing more. Besides, he said, he had proof that his way worked. Since the Bureau's crackdown began, the number of addicts had fallen dramatically, to just 20,000 in the whole country. Years later, a historian named David Courtright put in a Freedom of Information request to find out how this figure was calculated, and found that it was simply made up. The Treasury Department's top officials had privately said it was absolutely worthless. Back in Los Angeles, after a long period of digging, Henry Smith Williams was finally ready to make his announcement, one he believed would change the course of the 20th century and finally end this American Inquisition. In 1938, he published a book titled Drug Addicts Are Human Beings, laying out his evidence that the entire policy of drug prohibition in America was a gigantic racket, running right up to and including the bald man in Washington, D.C., directing the crackdown. Harry, he maintained, was taking his instructions from the Mafia. If you want to know how this scam works, he explained, you need to look at the story of Chris Hansen. He was a thick-set man in his 60s, with bright red hair and a strangely smooth and youthful face, known to everyone as Big Chris. He was Harry's bureau chief in California, and he masterminded the mass roundup of doctors there, including Edward Williams. "And we now know why he did it," wrote Henry Smith Williams. "Not long after he shut down the clinic in Los Angeles, it was proven in court that Big Chris was secretly working for a notorious Chinese drug dealer named Wu Sing. He was taking bushels of cash from the drug dealers, and in turn he was doing their bidding. The dealers paid Big Chris to shut down the heroin clinics. They wanted him to do it." I had to read through these files several times before I realized the significance of this accusation. At the start of the drug war, the man who launched the drug crackdown in California did it because he was paid to by the drug dealers themselves. They wanted the drug war. They wanted it so badly they would pay to speed it up. Henry Smith Williams urged the public to ask, why would gangsters pay the cops to enforce the drug laws harder? The answer, he said, was right in front of our eyes. Drug prohibition put the entire narcotics industry into their hands. Once the clinics were closed, every single addict became a potential customer and cash cow. Since his brother's clinic had been shut down by the Federal Bureau of Narcotics following bribes from the Mafia, Smith Williams reasoned that that must be what was happening at the national level, too. Anslinger must be in their pay. If the drug gangs win from Anslinger's policies, and nobody else does, the only explanation is that he is one of them. Henry Smith Williams was, it turns out, wrong on this one crucial detail. There is no evidence that Anslinger ever worked for the Mafia, and it's fair to assume that it would have emerged by now if he had. Anslinger really believed he was the sworn enemy of drug gangs, even as they were paying his officers to enact his policies. Henry Smith Williams assumed that Anslinger and Prohibition were rational, like him. They were not. They are responses to fear and panic. And nobody, when they are panicking, can see the logical flaws in their thought. Harry worked very hard to keep the country in a state of panic on the subject of drugs so that nobody would ever again see these logical contradictions. Whenever people did point them out, he had to silence them. He had to make sure there was no room for doubt. in his own head or in the country, and no alternative for Americans to turn to. Henry Smith Williams was never the same after these experiences. Before, he saw the majority of human beings as feeble dimwits who barely deserve life. But he started to argue that humans didn't have to be engaged in a brutal Darwinian war of survival, after all. Instead, we can choose kindness in place of crushing the weak. He spent his remaining years setting up a group to campaign for an end to the drug war, but Anslinger's men wrote to everyone who expressed an interest in it, warning them that it was a criminal organization that was in trouble with Uncle Sam. Henry Smith Williams died in 1940. Drug addicts or human beings remained out of print and largely forgotten for the rest of Anslinger's life. And ours. The book contained a prediction. If this drug war continues, Henry Smith Williams wrote, there will be a $5 billion drug smuggling industry in the United States in 50 years' time. He was right, almost to the exact year. The story of the Williams brothers, and all the doctors who were crushed alongside them, was so successfully wiped from America's collective memory that by the 1960s, Anslinger could say in public that doctors had always been his allies in the drug war. "I'd like to see," he told a journalist, "the doctor who claims he was treated in anything but the kindliest fashion." Chapter 3 The Barrel of Harry's Gun. While Harry Anslinger was shutting down all the alternatives to the drug war in the United States, across the rest of the world, drugs were still being sold legally. Over the next few decades, this began to end, and by the 1960s, they were banned everywhere. At first, I assumed this was because every country had its own local fears and its own local Anslingers. But then I started to notice something odd in Anslinger's archives, and I didn't understand it. In his letters, he was issuing orders all over the world, including to my country, Britain. He acted as the first drug czar, not just for the United States, but for the world. How? I started trying to figure out the story of how Harry took his war global and pushed his views into the laws of everyone reading this book, wherever you are. Once the doctors were whipped into line, there was one thing left that puzzled Harry. He was doing all the right things. He was cracking down on addicts and doctors and dealers. He held up one city in particular as a model for the whole world of how to wipe out drugs, because it adopted every single piece of hardline legislation he demanded. That city was Baltimore. Yet something, it seemed, wasn't working. Baltimore was, inexplicably, not becoming a drug-free paradise. Harry said there was only one possible explanation. Just as he had glimpsed the mafia secretly operating beneath the surface of American society, he now believed he could see another, even more evil force, secretly manipulating events. The communists, he declared, were clearly flooding America with drugs as part of a cold, calculated, ruthless, systematic plan to undermine America. Testifying before Congress, he gave details of a tide of communist heroin flowing from the paddies of China straight into the veins of white Americans. Why would the Chinese do this? They wanted to weaken the white man and to build a fifth column within the United States, an army of addicts who would be willing to pay with treason for their drugs. Now, Harry warned sternly, every addict was not only a criminal and a thug, he was also a potential communist traitor. His agents told him none of these claims were true. One of them later gave an interview in which he said, there was no evidence for Anslinger's accusations, but that never stopped him. But once again, Harry had tapped into the deepest fears of his time, and ensured that they ran right through his department, swelling his budget as they went. Whatever America was afraid of, blacks, poor people, communists, he showed how the only way to deal with the fear was to deal with drugs, his way. By conjuring this communist conspiracy into existence in the 1950s, Harry found a way to turn his failure into a reason to escalate the war. Drug prohibition would work, but only if it was being done by everyone, all over the world. So he travelled to the United Nations with a set of instructions for humanity. Do what we have done. Wage war on drugs. Or else. Of all Harry's acts, this was the most consequential for us today. He stayed in one of the best hotels in Geneva, and he would stare at the representatives of smaller, weaker countries and growl his orders. But just as Billie Holiday was refusing to bow her head, many countries were refusing to bow theirs. Thailand, for example, flatly refused to ban opium smoking, on the grounds that it was a long-standing tradition in their country, and less harmful than prohibition. So Harry started to twist arms. One of his key lieutenants, Charles Siragusa, boasted, "I found that a casual mention of the possibility of shutting off our foreign aid programs, dropped in the proper quarters, brought grudging permission for our operations almost immediately." Later, leaders were threatened with being cut off from selling any of their country's goods to the United States. Whenever any representative of another country tried to explain to him why these policies weren't right for them, Anslinger snapped, "I've made up my mind. Don't confuse me with the facts." And so, Thailand caved. Britain caved. Everyone, under threat, caved in the end. The United States was now the most powerful country in the world, and no one dared defy them for long. Some were more willing than others. Pretty much every country has its own minority group, like African Americans, whom it wants to keep down. For many, it was a good excuse, and pretty much every country had its latent desire to punish addicts. "The world belongs to the strong," Harry believed. "It always has, and it always will." The result is that we're all still stuck at the end of the barrel of Harry Anslinger's gun. But something else was frightening Harry. Something much closer to home. For the start of his period at the Bureau, he was finding that his thoughts were spiraling off into strange, disordered directions. His private files started to warn in frantic tones that addicts were contagious, and that any one of us could be infected if they were not immediately quarantined. And then, quite suddenly, Harry disappeared from the Bureau for months. Although nobody was told at the time, Harry, in fact, had a mental breakdown and had to be hospitalized. When he returned, his paranoia only seemed to have grown. He saw enemies and plots and secret attempts to control the entire world around every corner. At times, as I read through Harry's ever stranger arguments, I wondered, how could a man like this have persuaded so many people? But the answers were lying there, waiting for me, in the piles of letters he received from members of the public, from senators, and from presidents. They wanted to be persuaded. They wanted easy answers to complex fears. It's tempting to feel superior, to condescend to these people. But I suspect this impulse is there in all of us. The public wanted to be told that these deep, complex problems, race, inequality, geopolitics, came down to a few powders and pills. And if these powders and pills could be wiped from the world, these problems would disappear. It is a natural human instinct to turn our fears into symbols and destroy the symbols in the hope that it will destroy the fear. It is a logic that keeps reoccurring throughout human history, from the Crusades to the witch hunts to the present day. It's hard to sit with a complex problem, such as the human urge to get intoxicated, and accept that it will always be with us, and will always cause some problems,
as well as some pleasures.
It is much more appealing to be told a different message, that it can be ended, that all these problems can be over if only we listen and follow. After Harry finally retired from running the bureau, with a little